This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to our weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
We're going to start today in Europe. The march toward a unified military moved forward this week with growing support for a European Security Council and EU leaders signing up for a package of new military projects. For this story, we'll go straight to Richard.
Yes, it's a bit of a whole smorgasbord of different events all centered around this same trend. Ursula von der Leyen, the new president-elect of the European Commission, kind of got things started with a big... Well, she's one of the big people pushing for more military at the moment. She wants the next European Commission to spend a lot more on a European military. She's looking at ways to cut back on some of the kind of the social spending that the European Commission tends to engage in and instead put that money towards the military. They're looking at two-digit billion sums for armaments and military operations. She's looking to try and increase the budget, putting 10.5 billion for Europe's armament fund, 10.5 for the European Peace Facility, which is their military fund. It's a little Orwellian doublespeak there. 13 billion for the EU armaments fund. So she's been making this push. Emmanuel Macron, the French president, has been joining in. He's been traveling around Europe. He said things like, that NATO is brain dead, that Europe, we can't rely on NATO anymore. We've got to get our act together. We've got to do some things differently. And then the German defense minister, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, she has been giving speeches along similar lines. She's talked about having an American-style National Security Council in Germany, a kind of German military high command. And the German foreign minister, Heiko Maas, has talked about this a bit as well, so that you would have stability within Germany. You have all of these different coalitions and things like that with different objectives, but that you would have this military command structure above the fray that could coordinate military spending. And she's been pushing for more military spending. She said a country of our size, with our economic and technological power, our geostrategic position and global interests, cannot just stand on the sidelines and watch. And that ties in perfectly with von der Leyen's language of saying things like, well, the continent must learn the language of power and build one's own muscles.
So you've been following Europe's moves toward a military, a unified military, for quite some time. In your view, how much of a step forward does the fact that you have these leaders speaking so openly about these things? And we haven't even talked about the military projects that they signed up for yet. But how much of a step forward does this represent?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's these 13 different military projects that they signed up for. For working on unmanned submarines, new warships, things like that. In terms of a step forward, we see continually this clear desire from European leaders to have some form of united military. And I think we see that desire growing all the time. We see them talking more and more all the time about not wanting to rely on President Trump, not wanting to rely on America, the crucialness for this. And so we see that appetite just more clearly every week than ever. We're still waiting for the big breakthrough for that to happen, though. And this week wasn't that big breakthrough. At some point, they are going to have to really put their money where their mouth is. I think they took some incremental steps towards that this week. And that's where it's just one of the things I find fascinating about this whole topic. You know, we follow this topic because of Bible prophecy. You can go back and look at what Herbert W. Armstrong wrote, and he talked about how Europe's going to rise up and be this united military. And he talked about it even starting out as an economic union and growing into an economic union. And he said that all based on Bible prophecy. But at the same time, he also said that it's not going to be easy. Mm-hmm. You know, he forecast, again, based on Bible prophecy, some of the difficulties in bringing this union together. Mm-hmm. And the Bible even talks about it in Daniel chapter 2 as being a union of iron and clay. It's not a natural mixture. It's not something that gels easily together. Because of those prophecies, because of what the Bible talks about, even about human nature, you know, he knew that they wouldn't just naturally get along. So he said, well, you know, we've got these prophecies of this union, but it's going to take a big kick to make it happen. And I think that's still what we need. There's a lot of appetite there, but there still does need to be a bigger fundamental shift before they make meaningful progress on this united military.
A European Security Council, if this were to actually come to fruition, it does seem like that is the factor that is lacking in terms of being able to marshal all of the military resources that Europe has and to use them in a coordinated, unified way.
Yes, no, I agree. It's just we're not at the European Security
right.
Council yet. We're at the German foreign minister calling for it. And people have called for it before. But yeah, and I think more than just a council, it needs a strong leader as well. And I think that's something that Mr. Flurry has drawn attention to, that you don't see Germany taking decisive military steps until they have a strong, confident, inspiring leader at the helm.
Yeah.
So I think the appetite is there. So much of the ingredients are there, but we're not quite there yet.
So we talked a little bit about Macron making these comments about just the how NATO is defunct and that Europe needs to step up. There's certainly been those kinds of calls from American leaders for quite some time, just encouraging Europe to take more ownership and more responsibility for its own defense. Stephen Fleury was talking about this on the Trumpet Daily Radio show earlier this week. With the 30th anniversary of the Berlin Wall's fall, the fact that Germany is the one who seems to be most interested in this. It's the German foreign minister who's making these statements. It's Germany that has responded most to those comments from Macron. Maybe you could just talk about that aspect of it, the fact that it is Germany that seems to be most interested in following up on this.
Yes, that really is interesting. I mean, this was exactly what Herbert W. Armstrong zeroed in on with his prophecies, or not his prophecies, his forecast based on what the Bible said. Again, going back to the 40s, the 50s, when Germany was this hunk of rubble, he was saying, well, you know, Germany's the heart and the core of Europe, and ultimately it's going to be Germany that is leading this united European military power. And we're getting pretty close to that today. I mean, I think Macron is pushing hard for it because he thinks that if he does so, he can be Mr. Europe, that kind of strongman that leads everything. But you know, that's not going to happen. The Bible doesn't say it. And even you look at the protests in France, I don't think they have the unity behind him to sustain that. So what we're seeing with Germany leading this push is exactly in line with Bible prophecy. And this is something that the Bible forecasts. You know, very specifically, Revelation chapter 17 and verse 12, for example, it describes 10 kings which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power 1 hour with the beast or with this overall empire. And it goes on to talking about these kings making war, about them giving their strength and power to the beast, to this overall empire. So you have a union of 10 different kings, 10 different nations that pulls its strength, that pulls its power. And you look at other scriptures and they bring Germany into that. And they talk about how they talk about this power in terms of Germany, making clear that they're going to be a leading power here. And so, you know, that's exactly what Herbert W. Armstrong was forecasting. He wrote, for example, in 1979, the nations of Europe have been striving to become united. And he talked about how they're making all of these different efforts and how that the military would be a big part of that. And we go over more of what he said, more of what these prophecies say in a trends article on our website, Why the Trumpet Watches Europe's Push Towards a United Military.
Yes, thank you for that, Richard. We do have that trend article you can check out. We'll put a link to that in the show notes for the program. And also an article that is up on thetrumpet.com by Daniel DeSanto, Europe to Launch Security Council, for more information about that very important subject. We appreciate that. European leaders are not only agreeing to military coordination, it seems they also agree on their view of the Jewish state of Israel. A ruling from the European Court of Justice this week punishes Israel and effectively undermines the nation's sovereignty. For this story, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
This was a decision, as you said, by the European Union's Court of Justice, and they have decided that any goods that come out of the West Bank, the Golan Heights, or even East Jerusalem, these are territories that Israel won in the 1967 war. Basically, anything that is made inside those territories cannot have a Made in Israel stamp. It has to have a Made in the West Bank or Made in the on the Golan Heights or Made in East Jerusalem even. It has to have that notification, but it also has to put there also needs to be an acknowledgement that it didn't just come from those territories, but that it was made in a settlement in those territories as well. This is for any goods that is to be sold inside Europe. That's obviously where they have jurisdiction over. The individual nations can decide if they like in Europe to reject the decision of the Court of Justice at this point. But what's interesting about this and what is so disconcerting about this is it deliberately targets Israel in a way with this ruling that it doesn't target other nations that are in a similar circumstance. There are other disputed territories in which nations have claimed as their own or that do occupy or live in that territory, such as eastern Ukraine that now has Russians in it, such as the Western Sahara, such as there's actually 200 locations in the world where this could apply, but the European Union hasn't ruled on those cases. For this point, they are singling out the Jewish state of Israel, saying that you can no longer say made in Israel for this disputed territory. You have to say made in that territory specifically. But again, that element I could kind of understand. Okay, you have to put made in West Bank instead of made in Israel, fine. But it's the fact that they have to put made in the settlement in the West Bank, not just made in the West Bank, which then signifies to everyone buying it or deciding not to buy it that it is a Jewish product. That's how it's going to ring, because there's only Jewish settlements inside the West Bank. And so if companies decide to uphold this inside Europe, they're effectively putting a Jewish stamp, or not just a Jewish stamp, but people, bad Jews that are taking over somebody else's land, that are there on a settlement that are, this land should be the Palestinians, but they're using it for their financial gain. And so that is what the Europeans are going to have to face now, whether they're going to go along with the European Court of Justice in this decision that is deliberately meant to, they say, just inform their buyers, but really it's going to harm Israel's products as they are tried to be sold on European soil.
Trumpet writer Brad McDonald wrote about this in his Trumpet brief that went out yesterday, and he put it in the context of the rise in anti-Semitism generally within Europe. Maybe you could talk about that.
Well, it's certainly the case that we've seen over the past 2 or 3 years, the increase in anti-Semitic attacks against Jews in Europe, France, Germany, even the UK, and elsewhere. And that is disconcerting when you have people, individuals, coming out and harming Jews or bad-mouthing Jews. And it's causing mass immigration to Israel as well. I mean, my neighborhood right here 5 or 6 years ago wasn't full of French-speaking Jews. Now it is. This is a location where a lot of these French Jews are leaving Paris and other places to come and live in Israel because they feel threatened. The same is true for Jews in Berlin right now. I think this decision by the Court of Justice, though, takes it to the next step. This is an official government body of the EU representing, you know, justice, what is right, And they are, through this, institutionalizing anti-Semitism. The definition of anti-Semitism is treating the Jewish state or the Jewish people, or unfairly singling out the Jewish state or the Jewish people, as opposed to everybody else. And that's what they're doing through this. They don't have any other ruling for any other group of people, but this only affects the Jews. And it is worrying, especially in terms of the history in Europe. And that's what Mr. Brad McDonald goes through in his trumpet brief today. He goes back to what happened in 5 years before the Second World War even broke out. This is when, at the very beginning, when Adolf Hitler's party came into power, there on April 1st, 1933, they started a boycott of Jewish goods inside Germany with this slogan, "Germans, defend yourselves, do not buy from Jews." And although it's not going to have that type of label on the products that come into Europe, it is going to be cloaked in more language than that. It is going to say made in the West Bank, in a West Bank settlement. Basically, that's what they're saying. This is made by a Jew, and a bad Jew at that, because they've taken over other people's territory. And so, as I said, it effectively institutionalizes anti-Semitism into the law books for the European Union in a way that I don't believe, I could be mistaken on this, but I don't believe it has done so before to this degree.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would definitely encourage people to go and check out Mr. McDonald's trumpet brief, elaborating on those historical resonance with what's happening right now. And he also points to an article that Richard Palmer wrote called "The One Minority Society Loves to Hate," that was in a couple issues back in our print edition, talking about this growing problem of anti-Semitism in Europe in particular. It's not just in Europe, it's elsewhere in the world as well, but when you consider Europe's history, it definitely is extremely concerning that it's taking place there in particular. We'll put links to both of those articles in the show notes for today's program. Thanks very much for that, Brent. China is earning a well-deserved reputation for totalitarianism. We see that on display in Hong Kong, which we'll talk about in the second half. There's also its ongoing treatment of Uyghur Muslims. A Washington-based organization says it is finding evidence that China's treatment of this ethnic group is worse than is generally realized. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, there was a new report published on Tuesday, and it said that China has now built almost 500 concentration camps and prisons for Uyghur Muslims in the northwestern part of China. This was published by the East Turkestan National Awakening Movement. And the report, it included geographic coordinates for 182 different concentration camps. And then it also said that they have information that they'll publish later about 209 different prisons and somewhere around 75 labor camps. So it's significant because we had long thought that China has around 1 million or maybe up to 1.5 million Uyghur Muslims detained in Xinjiang at various locations there. But most of the locations disclosed in this new report were not factored into that original estimate. So this means that it's probably far more than 1.5 million of these Muslims that China's detaining, maybe as many as 3 million. Some are speculating. So
these are staggering numbers.
The figures truly are staggering. This is it's a modern, almost like a Holocaust type situation that's happening right now, 2019. And when you consider that there are only about 10 million total Uyghur Muslims and that 3 million may be, you know, basically in prison right now, you see just what the scope of this really is.
So maybe you could just give us some background why the Chinese government is so opposed to this particular group.
Sure. Yeah. Well, just in general, the Chinese Communist Party, led by paramount leader Xi Jinping, would prefer for religion not to play any role in the life of any Chinese people. The government wants to be the sole authority in the lives of people. There's no place for God, whether that's a true one or a false one. So the Communist Party feels very threatened by religion. And Islam, of course, can be a very potent force in the life of its adherents, far more so than other religions sometimes can be. So the government basically just would like to stamp out what it's calling religious extremism. Mm-hmm. And it is true that there have been some acts of terrorism committed in Xinjiang. There have been some of those, quite a few terrorist attacks there. But what's happening right now goes far beyond just neutralizing extremism. And it goes into serious, widespread human rights violations. And the goal for China really seems to be to not just destroy the faith of these people, but also to assimilate them into mainstream Han China. Inside these camps, the reports say that the people are forced to give up tenets of their religion, such as prayer, and abstaining from pork, and abstaining from alcohol. Like, they're force-fed these kinds of things. There are forced abortions, sterilizations of Uyghur women. The babies that are born are not allowed to have Islamic names. Instead, they're given, traditional Han Chinese names. Organ harvesting, just the worst, worst nightmares you can imagine. And they also spend a lot of time learning about traditional Han culture. They study Xi Jinping thought, they call it, the philosophies of their leader. They sing patriotic songs and things like that. It's incredibly Orwellian. It's terrifying to see it. And many who do go in, if they refuse to be kind of absorbed into the collective, you probably will never see them again. Mm-hmm. Many people who enter here don't come back out. Also, it's mostly men who are imprisoned. And a new report, in addition to this one, says that Han Chinese men are now being sent to the homes of those women who are left behind.
Wow.
So while the husbands are in prison, the Han Chinese are there kind of breeding the Islam out. So it's shocking beyond words, really.
Put this in historical context for us. This isn't necessarily entirely out of character for China.
That's right. Yeah, this really echoes one of the darkest chapters, I think, not just in Chinese history, but in mankind's history. And that is some of what Mao Zedong did in China back in the 50s, 60s, 70s. We've spoken several times about how in 2017, Xi Jinping kind of removed the limits on his power. He became essentially emperor for life, as long as he wants to be. We called attention to how that was reminiscent of what Mao Zedong had done, and just how authoritarian Xi Jinping is becoming, and how much his leadership is coming to resemble that of Mao Zedong. And Mao was notorious for setting up concentration camps and labor camps all over China when he was at the helm of the country. That was part of his cultural revolution. And anyone who didn't toe the line perfectly with the Communist Party would be sent to these camps. Tens of millions of Chinese people went there, and millions of those never came out of those camps. They died there. So to see Xi Jinping now resurrecting this practice, it's just one more really sobering indication, I think, of just how increasingly authoritarian and dangerous he is.
And it's pretty remarkable that these types of things are going on at the same time that China is extending its trade relationships with several nations. It doesn't seem to be raising many eyebrows among other nations that if they have concerns about what's happening in China, it's not preventing them from doing business with China. But maybe you could talk about this in context of some of the other human rights violations that we're seeing out of China right now.
Okay, sure. Yeah, and that's a great point you make. Even last week, we talked about American Express kind of agreeing to call Taiwan not an independent country. And that's kowtowing to China, despite what's happening in Hong Kong, despite what's happening in Xinjiang with these Muslims. And it's shameful for capitalism to say, we don't have room to defend human rights. Instead, we have to maximize profit at every twist and turn. But yes, this is definitely not isolated. We've seen hundreds of human rights lawyers in the last few years have been arrested. These are not dissidents. These are lawyers defending dissidents. There have been hundreds of those that have been snatched up by Gestapo, essentially, all over China. There was a man with the word Hitler on his shirt. It's sort of a combination of Xi and Hitler. Anyway, he was disappeared just a few short weeks ago. We've seen many, many people who protest in any kind of a way like that arrested and disappeared. In one recent case, it wasn't enough to punish the man who had kind of defied the party. They also went after the man's six-year-old son, forced him out of school, and they banned any other schools from taking him. It's pretty shocking just to see the scope of this. Of course, we've spoken on the show about how China went into Hong Kong already and arrested 5 bookstore workers because they had books there that were unfriendly to some of the Communist Party members. And then, of course, I think what we see happening with these Uyghur Muslims is far beyond all of that.
So looking at this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, why is this significant beyond just recognizing the suffering that it's causing in so many lives?
Yeah, well, the Trumpet has been carefully watching Xi Jinping's kind of increasing authoritarianism, because Bible prophecy reveals that as America's influence in global affairs declines, 2 different powers will rise up to take its place. One of those is a German-led Europe, which Richard just spoke about at the beginning of this half of the show. And the other one is an Asian bloc called in Scripture the Kings of the East. And the Scriptures show that that's led by Russia, but that China is right there with the Russians. And the Bible makes plain, if you look at Jeremiah 50 and 51, Revelation 16, and other passages, that there will be a massive clash between these two blocks. So right now, when we see Xi Jinping's increasing control over China's population and just his general authoritarianism, it's important to watch, because it does show how the Chinese president could fall in line with his fellow strongman there in Russia. And it shows how China will kind of be brought onto its biblically prophesied clash or collision course, really, with the Europeans. And I think it shows us how near this future war could be.
Where would you send people for more information?
We have an article called Xi Jinping Emperor for Life that we can link to. And then Trump Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry also has a booklet called The Prophesied Prince of Russia, which gets into many details about these kings of the East, focusing mostly on the Russian aspect of it, but also getting into a lot of the Chinese details as well.
Quite a stunning story. We do appreciate you bringing that to us, Jeremiah. Now to America and the public impeachment inquiry that started this week. For some analysis, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
The impeachment hearing started on Wednesday this week with 2 career diplomats, Bill Taylor and George Kent, testifying against the president. Although it did not go nearly as well as many of the president's critics and the Democratic Party would have hoped. I guess just in summary, it's easy to lose track with all these new news stories coming at you of why America's having an impeachment inquiry in the first place. Is back in July, President Trump had a phone call with the president of Ukraine. They talked about a lot of different aid packages America was giving Ukraine. According to the transcript, he then asked the president of Ukraine to look into some of Ukraine's involvement in the Obama administration's attempt to use unverified rumors to show that President Trump was coordinating or colluding with the Russians to rig the 2016 election. Ukraine was involved in that, and President Trump wanted to get to the bottom of what Ukraine had done for the Obama administration. But in the process of talking about that, he also mentioned some of then or vice president, former Vice President Joe Biden's son, Hunter, was doing some work for a Ukrainian gas company that he was being investigated for by a Ukrainian prosecutor. And he wanted the Ukrainian government to look into that too, since Joe Biden would have been involved in both these business dealings with the Ukrainian gas company and through his son or via his son and the attempts to investigate the Trump administration as well. So all that's pretty complicated, but in the course of that phone call, one CIA agent had made the allegation that, like, oh, well, President Trump's trying to blackmail Ukraine into, you need to give me dirt on a political rival or I'll cut off your aid. That's what the impeachment hearing's over. Now, if that's true, it does amount to a civil violation of campaign finance law. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that the people trying to impeach the president are not being driven by a burning and fiery zeal to make sure that campaign finance law is justly enforced throughout all the land. But on top of that, the president never explicitly said that in any of these transcripts. So it's all like innuendo. They're having to build this entire case on, well, the president inferred that he might cut off aid to Ukraine if he didn't investigate this rival.
So I just wonder if I think that the fact that this is politically motivated, these people want to get rid of Donald Trump, is well established based on what you've seen so far in the inquiry. Where do you see this going?
Well, because like I said, they're building this entire case on the president inferred this, which is a difficult case to make. Actually, I think on Thursday's Trumpet radio program, Mr. Stephen Fleury talked for about like 40 minutes on one Democratic lawmaker who's really stretching, even arguing. He said that hearsay can be much better than evidence that is direct, admitting that, well, we don't have any direct evidence, so we need to build this on hearsay. And with these two career diplomats, Bill Taylor and George Kent, coming out first day and basically revealing to the entire American nation that they don't have any direct evidence either, shows that the entire case is built on hearsay. Now, the Democrats can still impeach President Trump if they want to. They've got the votes. It wouldn't even take all of them. I think only like 93-94% of Democrats would have had to a vote for impeachment for that to happen. But after this whole hearing showing that there's not really any good evidence for it, that plan could definitely backfire on them. You basically like impeach the president and lose the 2020 election because of the corruption you exposed in the Democratic Party. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, wrote that back in his article, which we can put in the show notes. Can president get control of his own divided government? And now he's writing this not about the impeachment investigation, but about the Mueller investigation, but this the same spirit applies. He wrote in that article that it seems the harder the president's enemies work to destroy him, the more their own wicked ways are uncovered. And from what we've seen so far in the first couple days of the impeachment hearing, it definitely looks like that is still the case. The harder they're trying to undermine the president, the more their own wicked ways are uncovered. Like I said, we can put that article in the show notes, but then it also goes through prophecies in Amos 7, talking about an end-time leader in America, a type of the ancient king Jeroboam, who gets control of, he calls that it's like a king, and he talk about in that Amos 7, the king's chapel and the king's court. And Mr. Fuller proves in that article that the king's court is some of these government agencies that President Trump's been warring with, and that he's now actually getting more control over, ironically, in large part due to the Democrat Party's attempts to undermine him, exposing all this corruption that they've been involved in for years to the American people.
Mm-hmm. Can President Trump get control of his own divided government? A real landmark article from our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury. Again, we'll put a link to that in the show notes for the program today. Go check it out at thetrumpet.com. Thank you, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Most all of our listeners are aware of the Trumpet magazine, but you may not know that's not the only magazine we offer. We also have a Christian living magazine called Royal Vision. Like the Trumpet, it is absolutely free. If you want to better understand God's word and how relevant it is to your life, you ought to take a look at it. There's no cost, no obligation. It's a full-colored, top-quality bi-monthly magazine with articles about God's purpose for mankind, about family and other relationships, finances, how to apply the wisdom of the Bible in your life. If you want a free one-year subscription, visit thetrumpet.com/go/royalvision. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
We spoke earlier about China's heavy hand with the Uyghurs. We'll look now at Hong Kong. The crisis there has been going on for over 5 months, and it continues to escalate. To learn the latest, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the Hong Kong protests are now, they've been going on, as you said, for over 5 months, and the movement at this point hardly resembles the peaceful pro-democracy demonstration that it started out as back in June. In the last 2 weeks or so, the protesters and the government's response to them have really taken a sharper turn toward violence. In the last few days, a police officer shot a 21-year-old student in the stomach with a live round. The protester is now in critical condition. There was also a man that protesters apparently set on fire. That man is in critical condition as well. Another man, a 70-year-old, was killed yesterday after a brick hit his head, apparently a brick thrown by protesters. One university campus has basically become a battleground where students are using patrol bombs, bricks, and flaming arrows launched out of high-powered bows against police, and the police there are responding back with, you know, thousands of rounds of rubber bullets and also with tear gas. Female protesters have accused many police officers of sexual assaults happening while they're in custody, and parts of China, of the city there are just largely paralyzed by the unrest, which is actually an intentional tactic of the protesters. They hope to kind of suffocate the city until authorities will meet their demands. So the violence, I think, is heartbreaking to see, and the situation seems to be deteriorating quickly.
So as elections approach in Hong Kong, how might China respond to this?
Yeah, elections are just about a week away, which does put more pressure on China. And I think there are a few different ways that might happen. The first and the least likely is that China will give in to the protesters' demands. At this point, the protesters are basically demanding full autonomy for Hong Kong, independence from China. So giving in completely is not something we should expect from China. But there is a chance that we could see some attempt at compromise. We could see China signal a willingness to try to negotiate, maybe on something like the protesters' demand for an independent inquiry into some of the police brutality that's happened during the protests. And that could possibly calm things down in the short term. Option three is emergency legislation. We could see China and the China-friendly Hong Kong government enact emergency legislation, which is a part of Hong Kong's colonial era law. And this would give authorities free rein to impose curfews, to shut down the internet. Police would have broad stop and search powers and the ability to just restrict the Hong Kongers' human rights with basically no conditions in the name of restoring peace. We could also see a military intervention from China. The Chinese don't want to deploy the People's Liberation Army because of the optics of that and just how, you know, showing the world how brutal they can be. But if it comes to that, there's a PLA garrison very close by. Or there's also the People's Armed Police, which might be a better option for Beijing because of the optics. That's paramilitary instead of military. We could also see China possibly cancel next week's elections in Hong Kong if the calm isn't restored. And then the last option for China would be to just keep on playing the long game. China has already let these protests go on for about half a year now, almost. And as they're becoming more and more violent, more of the people in Hong Kong are turning on the protesters. They're blaming the protesters for these crises that are just swallowing up the city. And many of these are people who originally supported the protesters back in the early months when they were peaceful. So if China keeps on just kind of biding the time, it can win more support and slowly exert more power over the Hong Kongers. So we could see just more of the same for who knows how long.
We will keep our eyes on that. We'll know very soon, won't we? Anything that you would do to direct someone to for more information about the prophetic context of this?
Yes, we have an article called, it's by Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury, called What Are the Times of the Gentiles? And I think if you read that, keeping in mind that Hong Kong used to be peaceful under British rule, and you look at it today, what it's become under Chinese rule, that article takes on a lot of very modern relevance.
Well, thank you, Jeremiah. A violent exchange took place in Israel with a terrorist group in the Gaza Strip. For this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
This started early Tuesday morning when Israel decided that it was going to assassinate the head of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, a terrorist group that answers directly to Iran. This is the second largest terrorist group operating outside inside the Gaza Strip. Of course, Hamas also answers to Iran. But the links between Hamas and Iran aren't as strong as the links between the PIJ and Iran. So this is let's say, the trigger-happy of the two terrorist groups inside the West Bank. This man, Baha Abu al-Atta, he was responsible for the starting of the numerous rocket attacks we've seen in the past year, some of them very substantial, into Israel. It's this man that probably got the okay, or definitely got the okay from Iran, but he's the one that's generating the cycle of violence. And so Israel decided that it was time to assassinate him. They did so with a surgical strike on Tuesday morning that killed just him and his wife and left the rest of the building standing. And so it's also interesting that 10 days before this attack, the prime minister of Israel was forced off a stage because of the rockets that were fired by this man's group into Israel, which the prime minister didn't like as well. And so they've been looking for ways to try and knock him out because of how volatile he is, more volatile than most. And so they successfully did that. And so the rank and file of the PIJ then answered with firing 450 rockets into Israel through Tuesday morning and even into early Thursday morning. There is a ceasefire that's currently in effect between the two sides, and it kind of looks like it's going to be holding for now.
The ceasefire occurred after the 450 rockets.
Of course, yes.
Well, yeah, it's amazing how often you have, even in periods of supposed ceasefire, you still have rockets flying.
You're right. There have been 6 rockets fired after the ceasefire, yes.
Yeah. So what would you say is different about this from just the routine kind of conflict that you see between these two?
Well, there's a couple of things we can take from it. The first is that Israel looks to have renewed its policy of targeting leaders for assassination that it thinks need to be disposed of. I mean, at the same time this leader was killed by Israel in the Gaza Strip, another building was being attacked in Damascus by probably Israeli jets, killing the other leader of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad who was holding out there. And so you had two PIJ leaders killed, both answering to Iran, direct line to the IRGC Quds Force. Pick up the phone, they can talk to Qasem Soleimani, the head of that Quds Force. Both of those men were killed by Israel at the same time, which indicates the degree to which Israel can target where it wants to, and no doubt is a message to other Iranian leaders, Iranian-backed leaders, that we can get you if we want. That's, I guess you could say, a positive for Israel. It's also worrying to many Israelis that you can have, and that you can have 450 rockets fired at civilians over the course of 2 days, and then go to a website like Times of Israel today as we're recording and not find anything on it 1 day after the ceasefire is in effect. Do we just forget that an enemy fired 450 rockets at you? Yes, there weren't casualties in Israel because of the effectiveness of the Iron Dome system, defensive missile shield. But nevertheless, Israel was shut down on Tuesday. Tel Aviv employees did not go to work. Schools were closed. And yet Israel seems like it's fine allowing this to happen. Of course, Israel is also worried, and it probably, this fact that Israel didn't do much speaks to the fact that they have more of Iran's proxies to worry about. The big threat is what comes from the north, what can be fired from the Gaza Strip with Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad is only 5% of the arsenal that exists in Hezbollah's ranks in the north of Israel. And so Israel has said over the past 2 weeks they are extremely worried that Iran is preparing for a large-scale attack against it using precision-guided missiles from the north, from Syria, from Iraq, all at the same time. And they don't want to have a large-scale incursion into Gaza, which might then limit its resources to then be defend the northern front in the attack of in the event of a greater attack from another of Iran's proxies. So that's their calculus. But it does just even that fact speaks to how precarious the situation is in Israel, that it cannot effectively deal with the situation in Gaza for fear that Iran will use that to then launch more attacks from its the other proxies surrounding it.
We've been talking about this sequence of provocations that Iran has put out of just showing how it's increasing its aggression against Israel and other nations as well. We really could look at what's happened here in that same context, couldn't we?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is a group, again, that is funded completely by Iran, doesn't get any money from anywhere else, doesn't get any money from Hamas, and they love having the ability to show that Iran is leading the resistance against Israel. This is a way that they draw funds from elsewhere, from other jihadi groups. This is the way they gain friends in the Arab world as much as they can, is to show that they are heading up for Islam, the fight against the Jewish state. This is something that they have said that they wanted to do ever since the Iranian Islamic Revolution of Iran back in 1979, and something Mr. Flurry, our editor-in-chief, details in his book, The King of the South. It's something that if people want to understand Iran and what it's doing in the Middle East, its provocative moves, where they fit into Bible prophecy, they should certainly read that book.
And we've just sent off the newest edition of our new news magazine, Watch Jerusalem, this week. And there is the cover story, and a lot of the information in this issue is about Iran. If people are interested, that magazine will be available at watchjerusalem.co.il. You can subscribe to that or check that website out for the latest edition of Watch Jerusalem. I would imagine that would be going up online within the next week or so. Thank you very much for that, Brent. As much as Germany is leading the rest of Europe, it is in the midst of a serious political crisis with Chancellor Angela Merkel's successor uncertain, but it's also very close to economic recession. To learn about this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, all eyes were on, well, I guess literally not all eyes, but a lot of eyes of economic experts were on the financial results from Germany this week. So Germany, in the second quarter of this year, their economy shrank. Now, the definition, the technical definition of a recession is if you have two quarters where your economy shrinks. And if Germany entered a recession, that was going to be a pretty big deal. Their economy is officially in recession. They're officially going, going backwards. Things aren't good. The results came out. And Germany's economy grew by 0.1%. So they, just by the skin of their teeth, missed out on that technical definition of a recession. But still, that, you know, that's a pretty tiny amount of growth there coming from Germany. And there is a whole load of data that indicated things aren't looking good. Its industry is still declining in terms of how much they're able to sell. One of the big problems is that for Germany, the only one of the things that just really moves them forwards is exporting to other countries. So they sell a whole lot to China, but people are becoming increasingly worried, well, if the U.S.-Chinese trade war keeps going, then potentially that could be bad for the Chinese economy, and that could very quickly have knock-on effects to Germany. One estimate found that if Germany's exports to China fell by just 10%, then Germany's economy would shrink by 4.8% over a five-year period. A 5% shrink, a pretty dramatic that would be worse than a recession, I believe, if you had that kicking in. They're very reliant on the United States, and you have even One particular bill going forwards in the U.S. Congress would put sanctions on German oil companies, any German oil companies that work with Russia in building a pipeline. So you've got the potential of trade war between America and Germany. So these are the kind of Germany's overseas trades are some of the only things that are moving them forwards. So there's, yes, they just missed out on that technical definition of recession, but there are a lot of dark clouds on the horizon for Germany's economy.
And quickly, how do you view this? Why would this be significant prophetically?
Well, what we talked in the first half about how hard it has been for Germany, for Europe to get together for a united military, how there are some pretty massive changes coming into Europe, and it will take a pretty big kick to make some of those changes happen. And one of the potential changes that Mr. Armstrong and Mr. Flurry have both pointed to would be an economic crisis in Germany. And I think the data from this week just confirms that something like that is very possible. In the late 1980s, Mr. Armstrong said, well, you could have a banking crisis in America, that this could trigger Europe to suddenly unite as a new world power. Mr. Gerald Flurry had a Key of David program called the America-European Financial Crisis. He said a financial crisis in Europe is going to bring a strongman onto the scene. So there's a huge load of these different prophecies about a united European military, a strongman, some of these different things that we're talking about. And an economic recession in Germany could be the thing that makes that all happen. I read an article on this a little over a year ago called U.S. Economy, Germany's Next Crisis, that goes through some of those forecasts and those Bible prophecies, and you can learn more about this there.
All right. Thank you for that, Richard. We'll finish in America's presidential race, where one of the biggest items being discussed among Democratic candidates is income inequality. To learn about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, there may be more politicians talking about income inequality now than at any point in American history, with both Senator Bernie Sanders and Senator Elizabeth Warren putting forth multi-trillion-dollar income redistribution plans. But an article published in the Wall Street Journal this week entitled "The Truth About Income Inequality" really breaks down some of the statistics to show that you're not getting the full story. In particular there, they do note that in terms of earned income, the top 20% of Americans are making $300,000 a year on average, while the bottom 20% of Americans are making only about maybe $5,000 a year on average. And so these are the type of statistics you'll see when the politicians are having the debate. They're like, oh, well, the top 20% is making 60 times more than the bottom 20%, but none of those statistics take into account the income redistribution America's already doing. And it points out that, like, those people in the top 20%, they're already paying a third of their income in taxes, probably about $100,000 per family on average. Well, that bottom 20% is not paying any taxes and receiving $40,000 to $50,000 in government benefits on top of that. And so they say, after you look at the income redistribution we're already doing, that difference between that top 20% and that bottom 20% is maybe only 4-to-1, not 60-to-1. Mm. And so when you hear these debates saying that, well, we need to redistribute more income, they're not saying we need to fix the discrepancy between the 60 times discrepancy. They're saying we need to actually redistribute even more to get down to the 4 times discrepancy. And we're running short on time here, but we'll put an article I wrote a couple years back entitled "Nationalizing the Family" in the show notes, because that's like the British publicist Ernest Benn said that politics is the art of looking for trouble, finding it whether it exists or not, diagnosing it incorrectly, and applying the wrong remedies. And that's exactly what you're seeing here. The article really break down this. Like, the big primary driver, probably the biggest driver of income inequality in America is family breakdown, with the vast majority of the upper class coming from stable two-parent homes, and the vast majority of the lower class coming from broken families. And those cycles just keep perpetuating themselves. And fixing that family structure is the only long-term solution to fixing that 60-to-1 discrepancy, not taking more money from those who are producing as a band-aid to those who aren't.
Right, but you're never going to see fixing the family on the Democratic political platform, that's for sure. Well, we appreciate that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of G.K. Chesterton. The reformer is always right about what is wrong. He is usually wrong about what is right. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.